Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. Today, my colleague and co-host Sam Wong can't join us. One of the most important movements of the 21st century, one that builds on legacies of movement politics, is the Me Too movement. The movement has had a profound effect already on American politics, culture, and society. The emergence of this new phase of the feminist struggle, which dates back over a century, revolved and accelerated after the 2016 election and the emergence of Donald Trump's presidency. Me Too, though, has cut across many sectors of American life. It's, in fact, now a global phenomenon, but it's raised fundamental questions about basic rights in the workplace to the language we even use to describe familial and other forms of cultural relations, all of which shape power and power relations in our society. To discuss where we are in our history right now, we have with us one of the most talented actresses, authors, directors that I've encountered in recent years. Privileged to consider a friend, Amber Tamblyn. Amber is an actress, author, director. She's been nominated for an Emmy, Golden Globe, Independent Spirit Award for her work. She's appeared in numerous shows, including House, The Sisterhood of Traveling Pants. She co-wrote and directed the critically acclaimed feature Paint It Black, which we'll discuss a little today. She's the author of three books of poetry, including the best-selling Dark Sparkler, Any Man, which we discussed on this podcast a little while back. And today's book, the subject of our discussion, Era of Ignition, Coming of Age in a Time of Rage and Revolution, which is published by Crown Archetype and out now everywhere that books are available. Amber, welcome to the show.
Happy to be here, Julian.
So thanks for joining us. This book was really unbelievably powerful.
Thank you.
One of those books you just read and you don't put down and you continue until the end. And one of the themes in the book that I found really interesting is the importance of instinct and acting on instinct and the kind of constraints that women often encounter when wanting to act according to instinct. And you end your book with a letter to your daughter, which you say that to find yourself in this world, quote, pull the pin on your instincts and detonate. Watch what collapses, what bursts, what is forced to break out. What are you talking about when you talk about instinct, and why do you think it's so central to moving forward?
I think instinct is so important, not just for women, but I think for any kind of a marginal voice that has been left out of the larger cultural conversation throughout history, and especially in American history, because it is something that we've been told we shouldn't listen to, and that there is a sense of there are certain rules, there are certain guidelines with which we are allowed to exist. There are parameters for us, for women, for certainly for women of color, for anyone in the LGBTQ community. And I think to an extent also to men, even, you know, just the straight white men, which sort of feels antithetical to the larger conversation that's happening right now. But I think that, you know, we could have another conversation about masculinity and the ways in which men have been very much trained to have a certain kind of existence and to not be very in tuned with the way in which they feel or the actualizing of their own trajectory. So when we talk about instinct, when I talk about it in the book, it's really about putting ourselves out there in a world that asks us not to put ourselves out authentically and to not have the uncomfortable conversations that we are now having. Traditionally, that has been the case, is to sort of go about our own personal revolutions in a way that feels safe, in a way that maybe doesn't put us, you know, at the forefront of the firing squad. It doesn't harm us. It doesn't complicate our personal lives, our marriages, our relationships with our bosses. You know, it has not been the way that it is now, where people are feeling like they need to act and respond no matter the consequences. And I think that that's really important when talking about you know, this particular era that feels very, like I say, ignited right now. It just feels like it's blazing with a lot of different feelings and emotions, and we feel like this large collective raw nerve.
And some of the way in which you tell this story early in the book is through your work on the film and your experience with that. Could you tell us more? How did that relate to what you're saying about instinct and its role?
So I grew up, I'm 35 now, but I've been an actress since I was 11 years old. So I've been in the business for a very long time, and I've really only ever known how to do one thing, or really ever been told that what I had to offer my industry was one thing, which is to go into an audition room and kill it and be really great in an audition room and really be good at interpreting someone else's words, you know, creating something for somebody else. And when I say somebody else, I say predominantly men, because men were the ones that were always in the rooms, in the audition rooms. They were the directors. They were the producers. Often they were the casting directors. They were the co-stars. So I grew up only really ever knowing how to go into other people's rooms and try to impress them. That was sort of what my life was and career. And so the experience for me of adapting, so Paint It Black, my film, which is on Netflix, if anyone wants to see it, is an adaptation of the Janet Fitch novel by the same name. Such a powerful, incredible book. Adapting it and directing it gave me this kind of power and ownership over not just the way in which my life was going to go, but to also say that it's okay to fail on my own terms. So meaning that if the movie didn't do well, if the movie didn't get out there in the world, if it didn't make it, you know, onto a Netflix or find its way out, it really didn't matter, because the act of creating it, the act of being able to be the arbiter and the decider of my own creative work, a singular piece of work, and to say, this is my mind, this is the what it thinks, this is what it has to say, this is the way in which it has to say it, was something I knew how to do with poetry, because I had always been writing poetry books. That's something that I've done for a long time. But to harness it in this way, in the industry that I grew up in, changed me. It radicalized me. It changed me on a foundational level. And I don't know where the old, there's a saying of like, you know, once you know something, you can't unknow it. And that is very much how I felt about my power of saying, I know how to tell a story. I've known how to do it as an actress, and now I know how to do it as a director, just as I've known how to do it in a poem. So that's sort of what doing that, what the act of directing and adapting did for me.
And what year was this?
This was in, fairly recently, I'm going to say 2013.
2013.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And maybe 14.
And the title of the book, Era of Ignition. Can you explain why are we in an era of ignition?
Yeah. So for me, I've been trying to really encapsulate and find a term to I was trying to find language to describe what we're all feeling right now. Every single one of us, no matter where we come from, no matter the color of our skin, our experience, our socioeconomical background, no matter where we come from, how can we describe this, what comes after this sort of national existential crisis that we've been in, it feels like we've been in at least for the last several years, but then also this palpable rage that you spoke to in the introduction of this episode, and this idea of people coming forward and saying enough, whether that's women, whether that's people in the trans community, whether that's disabled people, whoever it is, coming forward and saying, we're not going to take this anymore. And there's going to be new rules and new consequences for the way things are going forward. And so to me, the era of ignition is we are in this era right now, which is a time of condensed change brought on by very palpable, intense anger, frustration, joy, all of the emotions that we are feeling, you know, post the election of Donald Trump, but also just in the real desire to see ourselves represented and heard in the larger theme of things. So the era of ignition is that. It's basically this condensed time of change that we are all participating in.
Another part of it that you write a lot about powerfully, and it reminded me of work from the 70s in the feminist movement, is on language and just on general cultural parts of our culture, which are really crucial to understanding why power works the way it does. What are your thoughts on that part of this movement?
Yeah, and like I also talk a lot in the book about, which is a more spiritual aspect, this idea of a Saturn return, which I was kind of surprised to find a lot of people didn't know what that was. The idea of it being that, you know, we change about every 7 years. There's like an existential rebirth that any one of us goes through based on the time in which we were born and, you know, where the alignment of the planets were at any given time. And in the particular moment in which we were born, any individual person. And that there really is this feeling, you know, people talk about going through a Saturn return at the end of their 20s, right? Like you kind of go through this place of going, who am I? What am I? You know, what am I doing with my life? Where am I going? It's no surprise that a lot of people really come into their power at the end of their 20s and their early 30s. You know, sometimes terrible things happen to people. For instance, Kurt Cobain was 29 when he committed suicide. I believe he was 29. He's right around that age. You know, you find a lot of musicians are putting out really powerful albums. A lot of powerful things are being written at that age. So when I look at that, when I think about the personal idea of a Saturn return, the personal idea of our first existential crisis that we have, and we're going to have another one. I'm going to have another one at some point in my life. You're going to have one. Anyone is going to have one. You'll have multiple existential crises throughout our lifespan. And I think our country mirrors that. I think any country mirrors that, where we go through these periods of time of condensed, radicalized change. And the 70s, I think the women's movement at that time, that wave in particular, actually also looking at, in studying a little bit for this book, looking at waves, I think it's been mentioned that the last real feminist wave happened in the early aughts with the coming on of social media. And I don't really think that's true. I think it was actually in the 90s with, you know, the Riot Girls and, you know, Kathleen Hanna and that form of punk rock, of feminist punk rock and of women sort of reclaiming their voice through music, which, if that's true, would totally speak to this idea of every 7 years things changing. And this idea of women pushing forward and us having a condensed cultural movement in wanting to change things in the world and in our country that feels larger than us, so that it's not just, so it is a movement. It is a civil rights movement. And that's really what we're in right now. And we've seen it before and we're going to see it again for sure.
And one of the let me ask one other question. It might be in the book and I'm trying to remember in my head. In your family, did you have anyone who is involved politically?
No. I mean, my mom is not political. She's a school teacher, but she's, you know, but she is very much just like my sister, just like most women I know. You know, activism and being politically active is not a choice for us. It's just sort of a way of existing. It's how we move in the world.
And then one of the figures who looms large in your book is Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
Your relationship before the campaign, the 2008 campaign is actually really interesting.
Yeah.
Tell us more about what your role was and your relationship with her.
So I was introduced to her by Mary Steenburgen, the actress who played my mother on the show Joan of Arcadia many years ago. And I got to hear her speak at a sort of private, it may have even been a fundraiser for Emily's List back then, back when it was, you know, first starting. And it was something like that. And I just was so blown away by her candor and the way in which she spoke and, what you know, without teleprompters. I've seen her speak a million times without teleprompters, and she just was so inspiring, and I loved her energy, and I loved the things that she had to say, and the way in which she saw the world, the way in which her values really represented this fair and balanced sort of idea of what is achievable, how we can push the boundaries, and how we can change things realistically. And so, in 2008, I worked for her campaign, was a surrogate, and I co-ran her youth outreach program with America Ferrera. So we went to so many states, I can't even remember. But
who's also an actress?
Yes, right. Also an actress, and a producer and a director, and and my best friend. I'm sure any Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants fans that are listening to this, all six of you, you will know her well. But so we went out and we campaigned for her, and it was a really powerful experience. And it was also, I think, the first time that I really saw my trajectory and the ways in which my story had been held back from me in the same way that Hillary Clinton's mythology was holding her back in a certain way, that there were people who just believed this truth about her that wasn't true. And we can definitely say that there is a lot that is problematic about some of her policies and her choices throughout her political career. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about the conspiracy theories, the agenda that was put forth by the Republican Party to basically create her and mythologize her into these almost anthropomorphic level falsities and things that just were not true about who she is and what she's done. And so I got to hear some of those things firsthand. And then this idea of talking to people one-on-one and just saying, well, what is it about her that you don't, can you tell me which policy? Because I'd love to talk about it. I mean, at that point, I was so fluid in her experience and her policy, especially stumping for her for so long. And it was so rare. I cannot express how rare it was that someone knew anything about what she stood for, her policies, or even her voting record. They would just say, I just don't like her. She's a bitch. She just comes off as like cold and not real constantly. So that was sort of my first experience in 2008. And then that was carried again.
And you collected newspaper images.
I still have them. I collected a lot of articles, a lot of sexist, misogynistic articles, but also like cartoons, newspaper cartoons. I also started collecting these morbid dolls that I would get at like gas stations and stuff. There was one in particular that was a Hillary Nutcracker that had these razor blades, like these knives on the inside of her thighs. And then there was another one where she would like sing a song about how she would still, even though her husband lied, she still stands right by his side. It was just crazy. And every time the way that the dolls looked too, they had this like manic smile of a lunatic, of a person out of control with no agency over their life. In the way in which I imagine, you know, from a patriarchal perspective, men and women who hate women would define ugliness, would characterize someone as being ugly and out of control and, again, monstrous almost. So when you like look at those dolls, I'm like, that is what's projected onto her.
And then in 2016, you describe in the book that when she was running again, and you write about your own fears or hesitation about joining the campaign and getting involved, and you describe a conversation with your husband, David Cross, a terrific comedian, and he tries to comfort you and say that your child will be better when she grows up, or she'll be able to do what she wants.
Yeah, she'll be able to do anything she puts her mind to.
And your response is frustration.
Yeah. I think that, look, as I said to him, and these are the difficult conversations, I talk about it in the book, that most women are having with their male partners, especially in heterosexual marriages, is just trying to get the other person to see where you're coming from and some of the frustrations of where we have had to exist and the ways in which we have not been allowed to express ourselves or speak to the truth of something. And this was a great example where I understand where he was coming from in that moment. And of course, we want to say, yes, our daughters can be anything they want to be. They can do anything they put their minds to. And I said to him, that's just it. It has literally been proven now, shown time and time again, that women cannot. We are not allowed to. This idea that you can just put your mind to something and it happens, that is truly reserved for predominantly men who are cis and white and usually heterosexual. But this is really reserved for that idea. So you're not really speaking to a woman's experience, because the experience is you can be the most intelligent, warm, kind, brilliant, sharp, dedicated, good person for a job, and you will still not get it. And Hillary was a shining example of this idea of somebody who was not perfect, but so qualified, had so many qualifications, so many reasons why she would have made a great president. And she still lost to essentially the village idiot. to the stupidest person in the room. And that is an experience that many women have felt across industries throughout their lived experience. You don't have to be a celebrity or a politician to have experienced that. I think women have felt that in every possible way. And so she really became the living embodiment of that experience. And that is something that I have tried to explain in conversations with people, this idea of what she represented to so many women, what she represents to me, to my experience, again, in the entertainment business, in trying to get my movie Painted Black made, and all of the very strange and sexist roadblocks that came along the way. You know, when you see all of this stuff coming out of the entertainment business about how imbalanced it is, how there's such a real pervasive lack of representation for both women in front of the camera and behind the camera, producing, directing, doing all those things, that is not unlike women in politics. That is not unlike the experience of watching her not be picked, and the person that is picked is just wholly unqualified.
And there's a line that I'm sure is provocative, not only about President Trump, but about the Sanders campaign. Mm-hmm. And you write, the deeply misogynist tone that spurred the 2016 election did not begin with Donald Trump. It began with Bernie Sanders and the paramount importance of his supporters put on making sure his man succeeded at all costs.
Yeah, that section of the book really upset some people, and I don't care because it's the truth. And I think even you as a historian would agree that it's important that we don't just say the right things or remember the things that we want to remember, but to really speak the truth in any given situation of the way things happened while we still remember them, while we're in the moment of them. And this is not me talking about an article I read. This is not me just talking about well, I did have tons and tons of pretty volatile, terrible trolls on social media who would say, you know, rotten hell, bitch, you know, feel the burn, 2020. And we know now that a lot of that was Russian bots and Russia's interference. But you can't take away from me the, you know, almost 30 states that I went to in the 2016 election and talked to people while, by the way, fully pregnant with a girl inside of me, and talking to those people face to face. I know those people. I know that that is where it's where it started, the seed of it, because also my husband is a Bernie Sanders supporter, and I support his support of Bernie. I'm not anti-Bernie. I'm anti the rhetoric that is against women. I'm very much against that. And to me, the bitterness, the weird, strange anger, there was this mounting anger that came out of that, started when she decided to, it was both because she dared to run again. She dared to do it. How dare she? She lost the first time. We hated her then. Then when she doesn't run, we love her. And she becomes our martyr. We want to say, oh, she fought so hard. She did so great. And we want to pat her on her head and, you know, send her off to do whatever she's going to do, not in politics. And then when she runs again, we get angry. And so a lot of that anger was coming from that. And I really remember that. I remember it right up to the moment. I had my own personal experience with him, where he behaved in a manner that if she had ever done that, it would have been national news and it would have been, she would have been done. I just remembered that.
What happened?
I asked to take a photo with him after Hillary had won the primary, because both I wanted to post it to, I wanted to send it to David because he is such a supporter of Bernie. And I also wanted to post it and I was trying to bring some of the discord and the separation within the party post the primaries to my platforms and to my base of primarily feminists and women, but to say, like, look, we're going to work together now. This guy has a lot to say. He's very smart. He's very capable. You know, he's worth listening to and for us to come together. So the idea behind it was just to have that. And he took the photo, but he was sort of in a very bad mood. And, you know, after we took the photo, he very quickly was like in my ear to a person backstage that was running this rally that we were about to speak at together. Was like, okay, no more pictures, no more pictures. That's enough. I don't remember what the exact language was, but it was very grouchy. And people were like sort of taking care of him and being like, okay, we'll go. We'll quickly get. I just want anyone to think for 5 seconds. I want someone to imagine Hillary Clinton, like, you know, snapping that angrily, telling somebody else they won't take any more photos to another person that was asking him. And there was only like 4 people backstage. I want someone to imagine Elizabeth Warren getting to do that or Kamala Harris. You can't, because we would not be allowed to. We would be deemed, we would be branded as something. So all of that being said, this is our past, right? And I think looking at the future of it, I have, I would be happy to express to the Sanders campaign, to even speak with them about ways in which he can speak to the women who have felt sort of pushed away and pushed out and turned off by him. And I would be happy to support him or any Democratic candidate, because I think they're all great. I think they're all worthy. I think they could all make great presidents. And for me, it's important to keep pushing forward and to ask to be a part of the change and the healing that needs to happen. But that doesn't erase the history of what happened before and those 2 elections. And so for me, so much of this book was about writing the truth of what I saw, and not just as, you know, a journalist who's on a plane with the Clinton campaign. I'm talking about firsthand experiences, both with her and with people who were either supporters or not supporters.
And then what was your experience? You write about it, a riveting scene in the first Women's March that came near the inauguration. Tell us what happened.
Boy, I'm trying to depart with succinct. I mean, there's so much. Mm-hmm. But I essentially went to the Women's March totally against my doctor's orders. I think it was a month before I was due. And she was like, you are not allowed to go to D.C. And I was like, okay. I said to her as I was like literally on the train heading there. But it was really great. I went with my dear friend Katie Jacobs, who I love so much. She's a close friend, and she was sort of the photographer and sort of capturing a lot of the experience of, you know, the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people filling into the streets. And I went to this morning breakfast with Cecile Richards, who's a friend, and afterwards, it was for Planned Parenthood at that time when she was still the president. And she sort of said, oh, my God, you're so pregnant. Get in our car so you don't have to walk there. And we all drove together. And it was really powerful, because the day before was the inauguration. And there was so much anger when we got to D.C. There was so much, you know, and you had the Antifas. You had like all these people who were very angry and coming there to disturb that inauguration. And I don't blame them. This is probably, well, it is the most hated president, the most polarizing president in modern history, if not ever. You would probably know more about that than me.
I can just take the guess. You can do it, yes.
So we went there and we marched, and I was so pregnant, but I was also not really scared, because if my water broke, I knew I was in like a sea of doulas, so I was going to be fine.
And then, soon after that, and I don't remember the timing, is when we're getting closer to the Harvey Weinstein story and Me Too with Hollywood. Tell us about the interaction and the whole conversation about your experience with James Wood and what happened.
So to keep it brief, just because I hate talking about him, but I had said that he tried to pick up on me when I was a teenager at Mel's Diner in Hollywood, which is true. He did. Even my dad remembers it. Like, I remember I went and I called my dad after I said this publicly, and James Woods' response was, she's a liar. She's making this up. And so, of course, you try to go and you try to back it up. And I called my dad, and I was like, I even said, like, do you remember the guy that I told you about when I came home from that show at the Roxy? And he was like, oh, yeah, was that actor James Woods? So I didn't even prompt him. He knew exactly what I was talking about. Anyway, the act of being called a liar like that so publicly with that particular instance and in that moment, you know, this was the year of Donald Trump's election. This was post Hillary Clinton losing again to who I call sort of the village idiot. And it just it set off an alarm in me. It all of a sudden immediately sort of did that thing of pulling the pin. And I realized that I had to speak to it. Whereas normally I would say to myself, let it go, write some, you know, snappy thing back. You can be pissed about it, but just don't take it too far because there's consequences for women who speak out. There really is. I mean, you're still seeing it with a lot of the women who have spoken out about many different kinds of men, especially in the entertainment business. In this instance, though, I wrote a couple op-eds. I wrote one for the New York Times that I think was like one of the most read that year. They told me called the title of it was "I'm Done with Not Being Believed," And I think that that spoke not just to that moment. It was not really just about this experience with this actor in Hollywood, but this was about the entirety of not being believed, whether that's what I have creatively to offer, what I am trying to put out in the world, who I'm trying to be, for any given experience for women in the entertainment business and probably other industries too, there's this idea of you're not good enough. We don't believe that you're good enough. This belief system that doesn't belong to us in any way. So I wrote that piece and I sort of burst. It was like a dam that burst open and I have not stopped since.
Were you surprised at the response to the New York Times article?
I was very surprised. I was
so you
shocked.
You didn't anticipate it.
I was shocked.
This thing.
Uh-huh. And it took a lot on my central nervous system and my health in that time because all of a sudden people were paying attention to me in a way that they'd never done before. Millions and millions of people and asking for my opinion on, you know, these matters. And that's around the time that Jodi Kantor reached out. She'd read the piece as well and said, hey, I'm working on a story. So this was actually several months before the Weinstein story even came out. It was about maybe 3 months maybe. So I knew that that story was coming. I'd known it for months because I had worked a little bit with Jodi and spoken to her. It's not a coincidence that she was working on that story, that Ronan was working on his story. It was not a coincidence that Time's Up was percolating and being formed in those moments. I think this is
the organization you helped
create. Yeah. Right. So I'm one of the founding members of Time's Up. But this is in the zeitgeist. This is part of this ignited era. And even the Me Too movement, which is now its own organization, it was originally founded by activist Tirana Burke over 2 decades ago. And the history of that is just sort of that Alyssa Milano had tweeted something asking women to say, use the hashtag MeToo if they had ever experienced sexual assault, harassment, you know, any kind of othering in their business. And it became huge, which is where I would call it the second iteration of the MeToo movement started in 2017. But that's all of these things sort of happened in this really wild 6 months. It was just like one after another, and it changed everything. I mean, sometimes we may not feel that way because we're not seeing the Ronan Farrow, you know, piece come out that's bringing down, toppling the big Les Moonves of the moment. But that doesn't mean that things aren't shifting radically and that it is not cumulatively powerful. And I think that the cumulativeness of it is what we have to keep our eye on, especially as women in all of the work that we're doing to continue to try to change things, is to know that they're small steps and each of them counts. And every time you look, you will see things start to slowly change. It's not a coincidence that we had a landslide of women, you know, who won in the 2018 election. It's not a coincidence that you have the first time ever Native American woman win or trans woman, that you have the Ayanna Pressleys and the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortezes who would never have a place in Congress before this moment. There was no space for them. I don't think they'd even be taken seriously. They're here now, and they have shown that complex women are capable of being in real positions of power and affecting change. And those women are sometimes not likable by patriarchal standards. They are women who are disagreeable, who are tough, who will push through the narratives of how they're allowed to speak, what they're allowed to wear, the ways in which they're allowed to interact. And that is so important. It's the same reason why I don't think that it's a coincidence that the first, you know, 4 or 5 candidates to announce their presidency were all women. This is something that is still happening. It's still unfolding. The change is still happening. It's happening in different ways, but nonetheless still equally as powerful.
And how has it been moving? I mean, you were an actress, you were a director and a poet, and now you're in, acting by instinct in some ways, you have propelled yourself into the middle of a major political movement. And you are a voice now, one of the voices of the movement.
I have complicated feelings. I would know no other way to exist or live. I think with some degree, I feel very emotional about the relief I feel that I've found myself, if that makes sense. Especially not knowing for so long how this was going to unfold for me personally. I didn't know if I was just going to be an actress forever with, you know, no one taking me seriously in any other way. I didn't know what my life was going to look like, and it was very scary. And I feel like I've found my space in the world, and I'm nurturing it, and that I'm not afraid to speak out publicly, because I know that while there might be consequences, it's still my truth at the end of the day. And I know that my truth has something to say, just in the way that I kind of found my voice by directing my movie and knowing that whether or not it failed didn't matter. The success had already happened. The success was in the making of it. The fact that I could do that I could create something that was wholly original and mine. And so, you know, things for me feel pretty solid and great, and none of this is easy, and it's difficult sometimes, and, you know, you get caught in the crosshairs and the fires of, you know, how people are feeling and how they're processing all of this information and this change, and that's okay. That is part of what I talked about at the top of this episode, of talking about having the uncomfortable conversations. No revolution ever had a clear path. It didn't come with instructions. You know, we're in a bit of an existential wild west right now, and that's good for us. The wildness of this is very good for us, because it is forcing us to test our instincts and to ask ourselves what we really believe, what we really will put up with or what we won't put up with. It's asking us to do that. The only way to do it is to do it in the midst of this sort of chaotic time, because out of the chaos will come real clarity.
And how did you, for Year of Ignition, it's written, it's a pretty straight book. Mm-hmm. It's a straight narrative about yourself, about these different parts of your experience we've been talking about, the political. Last book I remember we talked about the different formats of writing in the book you had.
Yeah.
In any man, you had emails and
prose. There was some poetry in there too.
This one kind of generally pretty straight? There's a few lists, but it's a.
I think I had been interested in writing something that was nonfiction based, something that lived in the world of essays and memoirs. Sort of felt like the pieces I've written for the New York Times as these sort of singular, powerful pieces that have something to say about a broader message. So the micro and macro of our lived experiences. And I wanted to write something that just talked a little bit about my life, and then also talked about how I felt, the things that I've discovered along my own path to who I am today, which is not always like great and easy. You know, it's been difficult, and there's been a lot of learning curves, just like there is for anybody.
And a lot of it, not a lot of it, but the moments you've discussed with David or even with your mm-hmm. daughter, you really, mm-hmm. you wanted to connect your own personal experience as to explain kind of some of the broader.
Yeah. I talk a little bit too in the book about, again, like the last couple of years and how tough that's been for my marriage and the conversations that we are having privately as a couple in trying to navigate the waters of this, you know, this time. And I share those things in there because I want people truly to feel less alone in their own conversations. Because I know it's scary and I know it's hard. And I know that that it feels like there's no direction. We don't really know how to do this. We haven't really done it before. And so we're all kind of just figuring it out as we stumble through it. And so I wanted to share the ways in which I've had conversations and also learned from my husband in the midst of all of this, getting him to see what I need and me also seeing, you know, how I come to the table in my own relationships, which is pretty profound. And that stuff was really tough to write about in the book because it's personal and it's my marriage. And, you know, David and I have been together for 11 years. But I want people ultimately, what's more important to me than anything is that we feel less alone in the struggle, in the difficult conversations.
And the book ends with a letter to your daughter,
yeah,
Marlo.
Yeah.
What did you want to say in the letter?
I think what I wanted to do is do away with these ideas, these sort of tropes about you can be anything you want, and instead really talk about how what expectations will mean for her should she choose to remain a her. I don't even know. I mean, I even talk about that in the letter, that it's interesting. She's 2 years old right now, and she's so not gendered to me. I look at her and I'm like, you're a boy one day, you're a girl the next day, you're like a living, breathing painting, you know, you're undefinable, and it's so beautiful. And somewhere along the way in our world, society starts defining us for us, and we don't have the chance to do that. So I speak to that some. I speak to knowing that at some point I will fail her as her mother. I will, because I am imperfect, and owning that early, and also owning that she's probably going to have to go through her own existential crisis someday, and sort of how to navigate those waters and those difficult times. But to really be as honest with her as I can, while also being as loving and supporting as I possibly can.
Do you feel, I'll end with this, but watching the beginning of the election season, that we are in a better place in any way than we were a few years ago in 2016?
I don't know. I think we are in a better place in certain aspects. I can speak for my own experiences in the entertainment business, looking at the change that's happened there, looking at the unprecedented number of people of color and women and people in the LGBTQ community, specifically trans, who have been brought into, for instance, like the voting membership of the Academy of Arts and Sciences, which is the group that votes for the Academy Awards every year. But to be brought into the Academy, and for them to be really diversifying their membership. I was brought in this last year. I was invited to become a member. That's a big deal. That's not nothing. It's not everything, but it's not nothing. And you look at, you know, the success of people like Ava DuVernay. You look at, you know, women who are now directing and doing things that there was just no space for us before. Now it's happening. We're producing content. There is real want and need and desire to have content created by women in the entertainment business. So those things are real, real changes that are happening every single day.
And Time's Up is...
And Time's Up just launched Time's Up Healthcare, which is pretty powerful, started by some women in the healthcare industry. And, you know, they're looking to change the landscape of representation within that particular industry and field. So having more women researchers, there's not enough, which is why I could go down a rabbit hole as far as how much is known about the female body, but more women in research, more women on boards of directors, at hospitals, you know, more women practitioners, surgeons, just more women in positions of power and authority. So, I think what's so wonderful about the Time's Up model is that it while it is an organization, it belongs to the people. It belongs to everybody. So if you see a place in an industry that needs more representation and needs to diversify and needs more strength in numbers, you know, you could say, I want to start Time's Up podcasts or something right. Like that. And you can create that change. So it's been a real pleasure doing that work and you know, creating all that we have in the last just 2 years.
Must be great to have such an institutional legacy already.
Yeah.
To all these issues you're fighting for.
Yeah, and very much so.
Well, we're out of time. So once again, thank you to Amber Tamblyn.
I really thought right now you were going to go, Time's Up.
No.
I was going to be like, Julian.
No. her book is Era of Ignition, Coming of Age in a Time of Rage and Revolution, published with Crown Archetype. It's available everywhere, and it's really a special and powerful book. So I urge everyone to read it. Thanks for joining the show.
Thank you so much.
Once again, you can find us on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Spotify. Listeners, if you have questions, just send them to us at politicspolls@princeton.edu, or you can tweet them at me at Julian Zelizer or at Sam Wong. Thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.